Welcome to the Junior MBA Coaches Corner with your host, Jay Billis. Today, Jay welcomes assistant coach with the Cleveland Cavaliers, Lindsey Gottlieb, head coach of the Georgia Bulldogs, Tom Crean, and from John Champ High School in Virginia, head coach, Walt Webb. And now, here's your host, Jay Billis.
Well, welcome to Junior NBA Coaches Corner. Today, we're going to be talking about offensive plays and systems, and we've got three of the best basketball minds in the game to help us with that. Tom Crean, the head coach at Georgia, Lindsey Gottlieb, an assistant coach with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and Walter Webb, the head coach at John Champ High School in Virginia. And I want to take a minute to tell you about each one of our amazing panelists and give you a little bit of background so you know exactly what they're about. I'm going to start with Tom Crean, who's been a longtime friend and was an assistant coach under Tom Izzo at Michigan State and really was instrumental. I don't know another word other than that is more than instrumental to help Tom build that program into a national champion in 2000. He left Michigan State to go to Marquette and built Marquette into a powerhouse that went to the Final Four in 2003. His best player in that team was Dwayne Wade, who obviously went on to great heights in the NBA after Marquette. Then he left Marquette and went to Indiana. That program couldn't have been at a lower point when he took it over, and he took it all the way to number one, multiple NCAA tournament appearances, Sweet 16s. Coach Victor Oladipo there as well. And then now is the head coach at the University of Georgia. We also have Lindsey Gottlieb with us, a player at Brown. I've never heard this before, and maybe it's happened, but I've never heard this. Lindsey Gottlieb was a player at Brown and at the same time was a student assistant coach. Which, if that's not a first, I don't know who did it first. But she was also an assistant coach at Syracuse, the University of New Hampshire, Richmond, University of California, and then was the head coach at University of California, Santa Barbara, and then the head coach at Cal, where she took the Golden Bears to the Pac-12 championship and the Final Four, and is now an assistant coach with the Cleveland Cavaliers. And last but certainly not least on our panel list is Walter Webb, who played at Virginia Union and Ferrum College, and for the last 20-plus years, he's been a head coach in the high school ranks. He's won multiple national titles and has been National Coach of the Year in high school and is now, as I mentioned, at John Champ High School in Virginia. And would like to welcome all of you to talk about offensive plays and systems, but want to talk first about offensive philosophy. And we'll start with you, Tom, and ask, when you take over a new program or when you're just starting out with a team, where do you start with your offensive philosophy and what are the questions you ask yourself as to how you want to play?
Well, I think the first place you start, which is understanding where people are probably furthest away from when they come in. And that's understanding spacing. It's understanding moving without the ball. And it's understanding what game speed really means. And then I think your fundamentals take off from there. And I don't think there is any fundamental that is too light or that is not important from the very beginning of how to catch the basketball. And so many players, they let the ball come into their body. You know, they don't make an aggressive catch. They don't extend their hands or arms to receive the ball. And I think so much of that is because so many times there's so little game speed work that's done in workouts, not necessarily in a team practice. I don't mean that. There's game speed in a team practice, but when you're doing your individual workout, there's not as much of that. So that to me is a huge part of it. And then it's just taking that individual player and really getting them to understand the level of athleticism that they've got to play with on how they catch the ball, how they step into the shot, the ground that they cover on their step in, the ground that they cover on their shot fake, the ground that they cover on their drive, all those types of things. But we were just having this conversation a little bit ago before this started. The one most glaring weakness that, with all that being said, that you cannot get away from when you take over a team, when you get a new player, is you've got to hold them accountable for playing with their eyes up. You've got to get them to have a level of vision, to have a level of awareness, and it all starts with playing with their eyes up and doing everything they can do to not only see the basket but see the floor.
Lindsey, how about you? Offensive skill development on an individual basis, but then how it fits into how you want to play overall, whether you're running sets or continuity or whatever your offense is. How do you go about developing your system and your way of playing?
You know, I think it's a blend of your philosophical beliefs about offense and then the players you have or the players you think you'll be able to get in recruiting. If we're talking about most of my experience has been at the college level. You know, so for example, when I was working for Joanne Boyle at Richmond, I think Did you enjoy Anne Cross over at Duke? I'm not sure.
Oh, but yeah. We're very good friends.
Yeah. So she was a terrific mentor of mine. But when we were at the University of Richmond, we ran the Princeton offense. It fit really well with, you know, the players that we had. It was a great way to get good spacing and ball movement. And then Joanne took the job at Cal, and I went out as her assistant. We took one look at the post players that we had, and we said, the Princeton doesn't necessarily suit this personnel. And so we ran triangle, and then we morphed into some other things. So I think that, you know, as you coach long enough, you watch enough film, you build your own philosophies, and then you figure out what your players can do and what best suits them. And I've found that I've had the most success when you balance the two, not try and fit players into a system, you know, that might not be conducive to their skill set, and at the same time not go away from your beliefs, you know, of skill development and technique to suit a player. It's a little bit of a blend of both. I think that's where I usually fall.
Walter, what are your views on that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, in building a program, you know, I think it's at the high school level. You guys are at the highest levels. You know, we like to find out where everybody's skill set is. In building a team, we can't really put our groups of offensive sets together that we've run in previous years because we've got different kids coming through the program. So, you know, basically we spend a lot of time, you know, just making sure that everybody understands their boundaries. And then we give them an opportunity to play within those boundaries. And like Tom spoke, you know, about, you know, spacing and, you know, we do a lot of different sets for the man, for the zone, but really putting kids in positions where they can be successful. You know, how we build from there, we try to make sure that they work really, really hard in the off season as well as in season and in their practices. We want to make sure that everybody's going game speed and competing against the margin of error. I think, you know, at this level, you know, in order to get to the next level, you know, it's a stat-driven, you know, scenario where everybody has to understand, you know, success, how much success are we having from this offensive set or this particular player or this group of players. So we try to find the best group as well as the ones that can be efficient, you know, while they're out there, both offensively and defensively. And then, you know, that leads us into our successful year.
How would you describe your offense, Walter? Is it more motion-based, or would you call it a set play offense, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, so we like to, you know, we do a lot of things out of the 1-3-1. You know, we try to make sure that, you know, we get mismatches with a lot of different movements. So if you look at the floor with all five positions, anybody can be anywhere in positionless basketball. But we try to make sure that all of those spots are full. And we try to stretch guys as much as possible, attack, and then kick opposite. So if there's a metal rod between me and any particular player, if I take five dribbles towards them, they're taking five steps away. We don't focus on the person that's necessarily in front of us. We want to make sure that we beat that person hard left, hard right, and draw help. And then from there, it's a catch and attack or catch and score mentality.
So it seems like flow is a big part of that. Would that be fair to say?
It is, just because, you know, it takes a senior team, you know, to have the maturity to go through, you know, third, fourth, fifth option, you know, and right now to get the most out of our guys, what we found is, you know, we meet them 50-50 and allowing them to play, you know, with a little bit more freedom.
Let me just follow up one second. Do you have a JV program at your high school?
We do.
So how do you incorporate teaching? So you're ultimately, you would expect to have your JV players playing for you at some point on the varsity. How do you handle teaching on the JV level, having your JV coach prepare your players for ultimately playing for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our JV coach is actually my assistant coach on varsity. And JV practices take place prior to ours. So a lot of times I'm there to watch. And while watching his practices, I can interject and he can ask questions and, you know, we can look at different matchups and, you know, obviously during the course of the season, we get an opportunity to see those guys play before our games. And, you know, that's the best way for me to be hands-on and to be involved in the offensive, defensive sets and strategies and making sure that he's doing a great job. And I don't have to say much. He's been with me for years at all of my programs. So, you know, we run the same thing A through Z through our programs.
Tom, it's been so interesting watching. You're one of the most innovative coaches I've ever watched. And with what you do with offense, flowing from transition into your half-court offense, and even within it, how you flow through ball screens, what's the most important thing in teaching transition into flowing into your half-court offense, if that makes sense?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest things, I think the term 94-foot court means so little to players. I don't think they understand just how big the court is, how much space is there. And with that space, how much ground has to be covered. So, you know, previously, like when we get out in transition, we used to really focus on first two steps. Well, no, now it's really more first three steps. It's getting the ball out in front, really covering ground. And to me, you know, downhill basketball, ground covering basketball is how much you're getting the ball out, what your steps are like, and really, really understanding the spacing that you have to play with. So one thing that surprised me, Jay, when I did television for a year and we travel a little bit, like I rarely went into a gym that had the NBA 3-point line down. And we've had it down since Marquette. And then after being out and coming back to Georgia, I learned from Brett Brown, I added a 4-point line, which is 33 feet away. I think his in Philadelphia is 30'8", but we made ours 33 just to keep enhancing like how important it is that you can play in space, that you can move. Well, being able to run, being able to throw it ahead, being able to not run to a wing, but run to the corner, getting guys to understand how far they can go. All right, in the sense of how athletic they play, not necessarily how athletic they are, but how athletic they play. You know, how do they stretch it? How do they get that ball out? And then the big part of it is they have got to be able to play without the ball, right? In transition, you've got to be able to move without the ball. It's and you've got to be able to get away from the ball, right? It's that's why the NBA line is so important. What happens is people invariably tend to creep in. They tend to come towards the ball rather than being away from it and put pressure on the defense. Great offense to me has got some components of how many two-on-ones can you create throughout the possession, all right? And that becomes part of your break. You know, how many times can you get it reversed, not just to reverse it, but reversing it that moves the defense. And then the other part of it is how much can you make the other teams 4 and 5, X4, X5, have to move, all right? And that begins in transition. I mean, it absolutely begins there. And then you want to keep that flow going in the half court. You're like, one of the worst things you can do is run the break. To me, one of the worst things you can do is run the break. It's not there. Maybe you reverse it once. And now we've got to dribble the ball back out and start the offense. So the higher that we can run it, all right, the more that we can run to the corners, the more that we can get to the slots, the more that we can make hard, purposeful cuts. Not decoy cuts, not cutting just to say that I did, but purposeful cuts. Well, the more then we don't have to reset, we can flow. And getting them to understand how much space is on that court. And then the last thing I would add to that is this. You know, the more space there is doesn't mean the more dribbles we take. All right? The more space there is, the less dribbles we take. We have a saying, you know, one less out front, one more at the rim. You know, so many times that taking one more dribble around the defender at the basket rather than trying to go up and through the defender, you know, get to the other side of the basket and getting them to understand how not to waste dribbles inside of the half court and or inside of the full court basketball. Like we'll stop the film a lot to count the dribbles on somebody on the break. And not only does that help the ball handler, but it helps everybody else that's involved in the offense, how important they've got to run to get out and get ahead.
Lindsay, what are some of the principles you use not only with the Cavaliers, but throughout your career in flowing from transition into your half-court offense?
Well, I'll try to talk a little bit about both. There are some differences. In college, I would say every single college coach, you know, in recruiting tells players, you know, we play fast. We want to get on the break because every kid wants to play fast. And then they get to campus and they walk the ball up the floor. So we would actually drill very simple things, you know, kick the ball ahead, 1-on-0, 2-on-0, 3-on-0. And then we had a fast break that was, there were several different options so that they felt like they were just playing. I think players like to feel like they're in control, like to feel a lack of structure, even though there are options and some structure that they've drilled built in. So in every shooting drill that we did, we tried to use the terminology we would use in our break. So first option is you know, point to post, dribble till they stop you, get rid of it, you know, pass it ahead. So we tried to kind of make the flow and the secondary break as second nature to them as possible so they could feel like they're just playing. With the NBA, everything is flow pretty much until you get to a timeout or a dead ball situation, because with the short shot clock, the spacing, just the physical size and the ability of the guys to get, you know, where they want to get quickly, you know, you're pretty much using early action and flow all the time with different iterations of that and sets called off it. And then you're using your, you know, your ATOs to set up specific things when it's a dead ball. But to your point, you know, like Coach Green was talking about, I think the better teams that I had in college were better able to go right into a set offense, you know, with an opportunity to push first and explore a break and then go right into some good action versus having to reset, look at me, try and get into something, right? If there was a particular mismatch and we knew we wanted to call something, then you know you're getting into it on a dead ball. But anytime there was a missed basket, we tried to push. And I think in the NBA, you're trying to push all the time. Guys are so smart. They know their own advantages. They know what we're trying to get into. And then you save the more particular intricate sets for after timeouts.
As to your point about freedom and structure, what are some of the principles that you provide on offense? You're still wanting your players to make the right read and use their instincts, but what sort of principles do you have for them or rules, if you will?
Well, I think, you know, taking the Cavs and the NBA, for example, you know, you have certain type of actions versus plays, right? Wide pin downs, on ball screens, screens in the slot, drive and kick, you know, and they're professionals. So they understand reads and spacing, not that we don't need to work on it, but you give them, you know, actions and types of sets that involve certain things, like, you know, as a coaching staff, you might want to control, hey, we want to, you know, work to this side of the floor, or we want to get these two people involved. But from there, the adjustments you're making are nuanced. So if you're playing a certain team and you know they're going to lock and trail the screens, maybe you're working on particular reads, or you know you have an advantage in this area, or trying to get, you know, X5 on the move more than, because they can switch with X4. So you're trying to have a package of things that you use as a team. And then I think game to game, or, you know, even possession to possession, maybe you're using nuanced reads, but they know what they're doing already. It's not a brand new set, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And Walter, with your players, how do you keep them from running plays instead of making plays and making reads and knowing how to play? I mean, you have to teach them how to play as opposed to just teach them how to run the play. Can you talk about that challenge?
Yeah, sure. That's definitely a challenge. You know, we've been fortunate enough to have some guys in our programs overlap. So they've gotten an opportunity to see what it is to really take advantage of mismatches. And within our sets and our transition, even in just our half court, if teams stop us, you know, what we try to do is really focus on the mismatches. We really try to focus on, you know, making plays where we're attacking the rim. Like, we have certain guys that's their job. You know, everybody has a role. And the roles that we assign guys, you know, attack, draw, kick, pick and rolls. And then if there's an isolated situation or a breakdown on the defense for the opposite team, then, you know, we're going to go ahead and take advantage of that. You know, there's certain times if the defender's guarding our post from the behind, then we're going into the post every time. You know, ball gets to the top of the key, and they're sagging off, you know, then, you know, we dribble handoff, pick and roll, take advantage of the middle of the floor, drag. You know, I mean, our guys do a really good job of doing what's best for them when they're the option. What we've been trying to make sure that we do is take advantage of when they take that option away, that we those other guys. So if it's two guys guarding you, you've got to get rid of the basketball. And you know, as Coach Green said, you know, more at the rim, you know, and that's, you know, we have a real focus on making sure that we take higher percentage shots. You know, if they take those rim shots away, then obviously we can look at the others. But that's our philosophy.
And Lindsay, one of the great resources for any coach has been eCoach. And I know you've been very active in it. I always say I get the emails every day, watch all the videos. And there's a great video that Brad Stevens did on screening and pin downs. So let's take a look at that now.
Hi, this is Brad Stevens with the NBA Coaches and eCoach. Today, we're going to work with youth on playing a two-man game against wide pin defense when they go under the cutter. Come on in, guys. Okay, Braden is going to be our cutter. He's in the corner. And Brady is going to be our screener. He's right here. If he knows the defense is going to cut under the screen, then Brady wants to set it lower. As I'm guarding Braden, Brady wants to turn and get me, but be ready to play off penetration. Braden's going to drive the ball baseline and make a play for Brady, and we'll play off of that. Okay, it's a perfect opportunity to use the way the defense is guarding you to get into a two-man game and get a layup at the rim. Okay, here we go. Cut, hop, drive it, dump it. Nice. Here we go. Now, drive it, and this time, instead of go for a layup, Brady, just get into the lane for a little jump shot. Here we go. Here we go. Sit, drive it. Good. Good. You can just open up for the jump shot. Last one. Now, Brady, as he drives it, I want you to pop back all the way here. Catch it, drive it middle, and then pass it back to Braden. Keep playing together and being unselfish. Set it. Drive it. Hop. Drive it. Pass it. Nice. You build a great togetherness and rapport playing together out of the two-man game off the wide pin. A lot of people play out of the pick and roll, but the wide pin is another way to get what you want from defense that goes under.
Lindsay, can you tell us a little bit, about that video, your thoughts on it, but also about eCoach and what a resource that it is for especially young coaches?
Yeah, well, in particular, I think that video is so great in terms of its simplicity. You know, in the NBA, we spend a lot of time with players individually before the game, getting them ready for the game. So a 15-minute shooting drill, and I find it effective, you know, to work with a player like, you know, Colin Sexton or Alphonso McKinney and say, okay, you know, in our wide pin down series, here are your reads. The defense is going to go shoot the gap. You're going to fade. The defense is going to lock. You're going to make this play or that play. And I think Brad does a great job in that video of just showing with a really simple drill in a two-man game how you can get a lot of good work done. But I think eCoach in general provides coaches with tools to take a look and say, how can I take some of the concepts that are being taught in the NBA and apply them to my own practices, whether it's young players or middle school players. I think there's some great content out there that's accessible to everyone just by going through the eCoach files.
You know, Tom, one of the things that I've always been impressed with your teams is late clock and how you handle late clock situations. And especially when you've had, you know, when you had Yogi Ferrell, it wasn't just you would have a high ball screen. So many coaches run in a late clock. They'll just have a high ball screen and let the guard come off it. You did some really innovative things. Can you talk about sort of the offense that you would use late clock versus things that you would do, you know, when you had a full clock?
It all goes back to training basketball players. You know, you're constantly – positionless basketball to me is about having a group of basketball players that have compatibility and connectedness with one another on the court that can make each other better constantly. When we played, you might be like Yogi. Yogi was a point guard, right? There were times we'd have Yogi be the trail, take the ball out of bounds. And we called more spots and concepts more than we did just, well, you're the three man or you're the five man. It might be, okay, you're in the five spot, like Chin. All right, the five spot, it might be Yogi Ferrell. So I think the more we practiced with putting guys in situations, I called it like a leopard offense. A leopard, all right, changes its spots, right? And then the bottom line is, where can you put that person? And then take 7, 10, 15 minutes a day to make sure that we're really, really comfortable inside of that. So we get into a shot clock situation, we might be able to bring Yogi to the elbow. We might be able to bring Yogi into a run-up into the ball screen. We beat Michigan State one time at the end of the game, and Cody Zeller, we had about 9 different plays that Cody Zeller could be the point guard in as a sophomore. And Victor Oladipo went to the five spot on an action. We're up two. Cody's got the ball. He's 30-some-odd feet away from the rim. Victor Oladipo runs up into the ball screen. Cody drives it left. He makes the bucket. We go up four. We win the game. Now, that doesn't happen if we just put it in during the game. That happens because we practice that way. And then we train those guys like as guards. You know, we would train our big guys as guards. We would train our guards to be able to be comfortable posting up, cutting, slashing, playing out of the elbow. So then when you get into the game, it becomes very much second nature for a guy like Yogi and for your better players to be really, really comfortable in chaos, under pressure, under duress, to go into a situation that they're not maybe accustomed to. And more importantly, the defense is not accustomed to having to guarding them in that situation. You know, that's what it is to me. And that's what we're trying to build in the practice, to get comfortable at it in the game.
Lizzie, what's your view on late clock? And I guess you could look at it from the standpoint of quick hitters as well. Combine those two things in this, but late clock and quick hitters as opposed to your regular half court offense.
So late clock in the flow, I mean, it definitely helps to have the best player, sort of have the best player on the floor. And I do think as coaches, sometimes you need to have the courage to just let that player go. We actually were facing Georgia in the Elite Eight that year, and they were Andy Landers, a tremendous Hall of Fame coach, was an all man-to-man guy, played us mostly zone because of the type of personnel we had. And then at the end of the game, he changed and went man-to-man, and I just let my best player, Leisure Clarendon, who's now in the WNBA, just go in 1-4 flat. And it was kind of the scariest thing I'd ever done, because you think about, you know, as a coach, you want to control that moment. You want to draw the best play you ever had. And I think the best thing to do was let her go. And she made a one-on-one play. But I think coach makes an incredible point in that players have more confidence when they've practiced it and when they've done certain situations. So for me in college, if there was a timeout game on the line, we were more likely to run something that was in our, you know, regular playbook, because we were going to run it well. Maybe we would make a tweak. Maybe we'd do something different so the other team couldn't scout it than to do something brand new and different. JB Bickerstaff's been our head coach with the Cavs for 11 games. And I was just blown away in those 11 games, how he could just come up with things out of timeouts that we hadn't necessarily practiced, draw it up calmly for the guys, they run it, and Kevin Love hits a big shot, or Colin Sexton hits a big shot. So that's the first time I've really experienced that. And it's been good for me. I don't know, is that because these guys can just do things, or because Kevin Love's probably done something similar, you know, 20,000 times in his career? I'm not sure. So it's good to see these guys be able to do that, because that'll probably expand my philosophies around that. But in college, I always went to something that we knew we could run and where we had an advantage, and then trying to, you know, make sure it wasn't quite scoutable.
Have you found in teaching that one of the best ways is game situations, like putting a specific situation up on the clock and playing it out so your team gets the experience, at least in practice, of having done it?
Absolutely. And what I've found, that the more you do that, you're probably never going to get that exact situation in the game, you know, whether you put 17 seconds or what have you. But the more you've done any situations, you get to teach through them. You get a different level of calm in the game. You know, you can look at them in the huddle and sort of been like, hey, we've been here before, even if we simulated it and even if it wasn't exactly the same. So for youth coaches, for, you know, high school and college coaches, I think putting your players in those situations as much as you can, in game simulated situations in practice, is invaluable.
Tom, what are some of the game situations you use for late clock?
Well, I'm taking notes. That's why I'm not putting my head down to look at the phone. I'm taking notes with what people are saying in here. And Lindsay's exactly right. When you talk about, it's a different set of calm. And I think that there's such a synergy of confidence when people feel, especially when they've had some success in a late game situation, but when they feel like they're going to have success in a late game situation. And I think for me, you know, it starts with advantage, disadvantage situations, you know, before you get into a specific situation. It's getting them comfortable in the chaos of being one short or having one extra. And putting that pressure on, where there's a definite reliance on one another because of that advantage disadvantage situation. But then the other part of it, some of my favorite games have been to take a score. So let's just say, let's go 60-60, okay? And we put 2 minutes and 30 seconds on the clock. and we're going to start the clock at 65, or we're going to start the clock at 67. So you're getting some live scrimmaging inside of it. And then all of a sudden, when somebody hits that number, you know, now you're running the clock. And I think that's really, really important. I think some basic ones and that are really can be good is up 10, 5 minutes to go, down 10, 5 minutes to go. What I love to do, Jay, because I look at basketball in a lot of ways this way with late game situations. There are definitely players that can take you from being up 4 to up 12 in a late game situation. There's a lot of guys that can do that. All right. There's even more guys, unfortunately, sometimes, or ladies, that can take you from being down 4 to down 12 because they get into the game and they don't understand what we have to do to overcome it. When you got to go from down 4 to up 4, now that's the separation of your team. So like I'll tell my staff, when we come up with things, let's think in those terms. Let's think of something that we've got to overcome, okay? And then we've got to put it away, right? Because it's really easy to okay, well, now we've got to come back all the way, or now we've got to hold on to the lead. And there's a great value to that, especially with holding on to a lead. But when you've got to go from down 4, get the lead, and then hold the lead, all right, that to me is where you can really, really make a difference for your team. So whatever that variance is, and Lindsay hit it right, it's not as much about what the situation is as the fact that you've practiced it, and that calming yet confident part of it comes to them, you know, inside of it. And any time that you can put a score that they have to achieve or a time that they've got to play in, there's no question you're making your team better.
Walter, when you're in a game situation, late game, your team's on defense, your opponent makes the shot, and all of a sudden now you're down 1, maybe down 2. What's your philosophy in the last minute of the game or less? When you have to have a bucket on this possession, do you call a timeout or do you rely on your team to go down and hopefully go against a team that hasn't been with their coach? Maybe their defense isn't able to get set. How do you like to view that?
I've done both. I've called timeouts. I've let the kids play. A lot of it just depends on the personnel that we have that's on the court at that particular time. You know, we're very, very comfortable, as both Lindsay, you know, and Coach Green said, you know, as far as being prepared to run things that we've done before. We practice on taking the ball out at different spots on the floor based on where the officials may give it, you know, transition plays. You know, what I found over the years is that it's extremely easy when you know how. You don't know how to do something, it's extremely frustrating and you're not going to get much success from it. So, you know, the guys that are out there, you know, on the court, we want to make sure that they're very familiar with the situation and can make the necessary read. We had a game this year where we had just been focusing on trusting our teammates. You know, everybody sometimes at the end of the game, you know, is a pretty big game for us and everybody wants to take the big shot. That's a good problem to have, but it's not necessarily the right thing because you got to make the right pass and make the right play. So we had one young man that hadn't taken a jump shot the whole game. And we had three guys out there that were extremely hot all night and a fourth guy, you know, just trailing the play. And I just told our point guard, I said, listen, they're not going to foul. Just push the ball. Let's make a read. Let's attack the left side of the floor. You know, I told the young man, Ishmael, when the help comes, just sit on it in the corner. Don't leave. And he looked at me as if to say, what do you want? You want me to take the shot? I have it. And I told him, catch it and pull the trigger. It's a tie ball game. You know, we're going to live with the results. And, you know, just because the kids believed in each other, made the pass, you know, I mean, it, just being in that situation, he had never been in that particular situation, but he was the guy that was in the game at that particular time. And he knocked it down. And again, it's just everybody else knew what to do. All he had to do was just catch and shoot. He had never been in that situation, but he had taken that shot several times. So, you know, we were very fortunate to be, you know, in that scenario. But yes, it's very important to make sure that the kids are prepared, you know, as much as possible, as much as we possibly can. As Lindsay said, you can't prepare for every single solitary thing, but you can be pretty close. And that's what we try to do.
He's exactly right with personnel. And I would add another word to personnel is trust.
Sure.
You know, the trust that you have with people at the end of the game. And then the other part of it, and this is where assistant coaches can be so incredibly valuable to the whole fabric of what's going on with the staff, is how do they play late game situations. Like, you may have every intention to have a great side out of bounds, but if this team has got a tendency or there's a chance that they could switch the defenses and now put somebody on the ball that you're going to have an incredibly hard time getting the ball in bounds, that's a huge factor. And because I think you've got to look at, you have your contingency plans, you have your plan, but you've got to look at what's realistic. And sometimes you have to, the hardest thing is to get the ball in bounds. Well, the second hardest thing is who's going to catch it, you know, under pressure. And I think you have to think about those things, but the trust level of your team is so important because you want to get a great shot. You want to get the shot, not necessarily the shot that you've drawn up, but you want a great shot. You don't want hero ball. You don't want somebody that feels it's their birthright that they have to take that shot at the expense of what the best play is. And then the other thing that I would add to it, and this comes from the study of late game, one of the best pieces of advice I got in late game situations, my first year at Marquette, I went for a day and spent time with Jeff Van Gundy and Tom Thibodeau and Brendan Malone when they were with the Knicks. And I learned a lot, but I learned something from Jeff and Tom. They would take a +6/-6 game, last 4 minutes of a game in the NBA, any game that was +6 or -6, and they would keep that all on one tape and study it. And it is amazing what you learn about a team in those type of situations, well, especially the late game. Well, one thing that invariably comes from that is how do individual players – play at the end of the game? And more often than not, it's going to be an attitude of, I'm not going to let my man score. I'm not going to let my man catch the ball. So I think in your late game situation, you have to look at where can you get a back cut? Where can you get a clear out? Where can you get a situation where you know that person's not going to come off and you've got a chance at an easier basket? How much confusion can you create at the end of the game without being confused yourself on where the shot is going to come from, what action you're going to run, or if you're going to be able to get the ball in bounds. And I think those things are, you can't spend enough time mentally or in the film room as a coach. All right? You can spend too much time on the court like you can with anything else, but you cannot spend enough time as a coach in preparing for those situations mentally and with your staff and having a plan for it as you go into it.
Tom, do you practice most of your late game stuff at the end of practice so they're tired, which simulates, you know, end of game, you're going to be tired, you're going to have fouls, you're going to be banged up. Do you do that stuff at the end of practice to simulate that?
I try to mix it up, but the fatigue has got to be a part of it. One thing I like to do in scouting, and this is without the fatigue part, is to get the team's attention. We're going to start with the late game situations. And I found whether it was at Marquette, whether it was Indiana, I don't do it every game, but that creates a level of urgency that, oh man, coach thinks we're going to lose, you know, or coach thinks we're going to get beat. And that's not a bad place to be sometimes with your team. You want that urgency, especially if they feel like that's not the case. So I try to mix that up. But for the most part, it's going to be inside some fatigue level of practice. One piece of advice I got a long time ago from Bill Parcells, and he was in Dallas, and I'm sure he had done this before. And I thought this was absolutely brilliant. I might have shared this with you, Jay, before, but I'm going to share it with everybody. I think it's brilliant. The only person that knew when he was going to go to a certain situation in practice was his video guy. He didn't tell his coordinators. He didn't tell his staff. He certainly didn't tell the players. At some point in time in practice, he would know when he was just going to absolutely change things and create a situation that wasn't normal, you know, an unobvious situation. And it might be at the 1 yard line. It would be some type of thing that nobody was ready for. And what that did in my mind is it just re-exemplified the fact is you want your players off guard in those situations as much as possible so that they learn how to be together inside of that chaos. Because no matter what's going on in the game, okay, and no matter how hard you work to build that calmness, to build that confidence, it is a different mindset at the end of the game. And the more situations that you can put them in that are invariably not that they're different than your normal practice, different than your normal scrimmaging, different than the normal expectation of when it's coming, can be really, really good. I never forgot when Coach Parcells said that. And I don't do it every day, but I definitely try to add it in there. And we try to get something accomplished with it.
That's a great point. Together in chaos and trying to create that chaos so your players can learn from it. You know, Lindsay, I've always been a big admirer of your clinics on zone offense. And whether it's continuity or quick hitters, you know, you've got so many great things that your teams can do against zone, which isn't always easy to do. for coaches. Can you talk a little bit about your zone offensive philosophy and how it may differ from your philosophy going against man defenses?
Yeah, I think I had to try to become as much of an expert in zone as possible out of necessity. So you mentioned Cal was my second head coaching job. So get the Cal job and, you know, feeling a little more confident, like I'm not going to be outworked. We're going to be really prepared. We had some talent returning. And I remember I had an offensive progression. You know, I probably wrote it out in August for October practices of, you know, ball screen reads and spacing and wide pin downs. And, you know, we were on it and we had a group that was really bought in and, you know, went into our first eight games and we probably faced about five total possessions of man to man because we were super athletic. We had players who were really good off the dribble. We had terrific post play and we didn't shoot it great. So when teams were thinking, you know, pick your poison, we faced a lot of zone. So, I really wanted to make sure, you know, the latter half of that year going into conference and the next year when we had everyone back and it was our Final Four team, that more than anything, I wanted the players confident when we faced zone. So much so that that was part of the messaging. We got the players to say, I hope they play zone when we were prepping for the team going forward. Because mentality-wise, and you even see this in the NBA a little bit, players don't grow up facing that much zone. You know, you're playing by yourself in the park. You're not thinking about how to attack a zone. You're, you know, growing up playing club basketball, you just, they're not very nuanced in how to attack it. So what we did specifically at Cal with the personnel we had with zone is we tried to still go to our strengths that people were trying to game plan against. So, you know, we had a very unique zone offense that was a 1-4 flat and kept two post players still low. And what I would try and message to our players was, if they could guard us man-to-man, they would be in man-to-man. They can't. So we tried to create as much matchup situations as we could. So we tried to have our post players seal, you know, the zone and get one-on-one touches. And there were rules. If it's one-on-one, the ball's going in and we're going to score. But then you start to, you know, learn your overloads. And, okay, if they're going to double here, here's where the open shot is going to come from. That gave us a lot of corner threes. And it gave the point guard a lot of penetration decision-making options. So drive and dish, drive and kick. If it ends up being a one-on-one, you go one-on-one. So that was a unique offense. We called that 12, and it was a 1-4 flat. And then, you know, to go back to your point about shifting a little bit to your personnel, when we got a more stretch four, we did a different zone offense. We called it gaps four. That was more of a four around one. It highlighted the four perimeter players and one low post threat. We had very big wings at the time, so it allowed interchangeable parts between the two, three, and the four on the floor. And so it allowed the twos and threes to get behind the zone and use their height. So I would say it was a mixture of just mentality and making sure our players were confident against zone and then drilling it and getting the highest comfort level we can. You see in the NBA now, you know, there are teams who mix in zone for 2, 3, 4 possessions. And ultimately the players are too good, right? The NBA players are going to figure it out. They're going to get off a corner three. You know, you're going to give up open shots, but you might steal 2 or 3 possessions where, you know, even the best players in the world are a little frozen because they're not used to their pick and roll. You know, they're not used to not being able to just get into their pick and roll or get into their isolation game. So I think it's the reason you see so much zone in college is that it neutralizes, you know, better talent at times. And so as a coach, it challenged me to make sure that we were capable of attacking it at a really successful rate.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I remember Bob Knight telling me years ago that he said, you play me man, you decide who guards my best player. You play me zone, I decide who guards my best player. And to that point, I remember in one of your clinics that I saw years ago, you had a quick hitters where you take your best shooter and pair your best shooter with your best finisher. And I think you had one called West where it's like a baseline runner and screening the zone to where you made the low defender on the wing make a decision. You know, do you guard the cutter or do you stay in and guard inside? And can you talk about sort of the quick hitting aspect of some of your sets?
Sure. So we had, you know, as you mentioned, about 3 continuities, but then you have those quick hitters because you go back to thinking about the opposing coach's mindset. And there's, in college, there's, you know, 3 prep days for 1 game. In the NBA, it's game, you know, and you're learning through games. But in college, you're spending a lot of time prepping for the other team or prepping your own stuff relative to how they think they're going to guard you. So we would know that we should have the advantage on offense. When the other team was going to play a zone, they wouldn't be able to prepare for all the quick hitters out of it. You can't, especially if it's a team that doesn't traditionally play zone and they're just trying to figure out their shifts. So that West play, you know, we ran that one to death. And if you put your best shooter would start on the same side as our best post player, and the ball would shift because you get the defense to shift, and you put that low player in the zone in a predicament. If they stay in and double team the post, and you know, you've the weak side players are screening in the zone as it shifts, so that the weak side wing, you know, who now becomes the strong side wing, has a decision. They either follow the shooter to the corner, and then your point guard kind of gets an angle to the big kid behind the zone, or they sit in and double the post and you get a wide open three. And you know, the fun part about that is when you're watching the film back, you can always look over to the other team's bench, and the one assistant coach who scouted was knows what's coming, and he's going, oh, or she's going, oh no, here it comes, and you're scoring on it anyway. And I go back to just the players like that, right? So they want freedom and they want to be able to just play, but there's also a confidence in, hey, you're going to play us zone. We know, you know, we can outscore you or we can pick you apart in certain areas. And I found that the more we worked on some of those things, it just bred an overall confidence that helps you in every aspect of the game.
Tom, what do you do as far as your zone attack, your zone offense versus quick hitting plays that you may have where you'll screen the zone, overload it, or go after a matchup in that zone?
Well, I think zone offense starts with how are we going to get fouled? And it really does. And now that's not the only thing, but how are we going to get fouled? Where is the best chance? And outside of having that post up that is going to get there on a seal or get there on a slip, it's usually in the middle of the floor, right? Where you can get some type of one-on-one, even if it's just for a bit, but where can you get the foul? The other part of it for me is, and this has helped my man offense a lot, is getting behind the defense. You know, being in the short corner, deep, butt to the baseline, being in the deep corner. You know, how much can we get behind it? But the bottom line is, I think, how much can you get seals, all right, get screens, more sealing than screening, but who do they have to have to make the zone work? Not necessarily the personnel, the actual person, but what position? Like the 1-3-1, one thing we love to do against the 1-3-1 is seal the top, the middle man in the 1-3-1. No matter how high he comes, we try to seal him. And because that guy invariably is the guy that's like a rover, right? He can move, he can play. Now, you might have a 1-3-1 where the player is so good, okay, on the bottom of the zone, it going corner to corner. Northwestern, when I was early in the Big Ten with Bill Carmody, was the coach at Northwestern. He had a player, Juice Thompson, in the bottom of his 1-3-1. Like, if you didn't game plan for Juice Thompson and the way he moved in the bottom of the zone, you were going to have a problem. So, to me, it's that more than it's actually the continuity or the sets. And I think where it's also evolved, I mean, you think about the late game situation. If you don't have a play that you are comfortable working against man or zone, at the end of the game, you've just given the defense an advantage. Well, I think it's the same thing against the zone. It's with your break when you come down. And I think it's also with how you attack it. And to me, it goes back to, you can't hold the ball. Okay. There's so many 2-3s. What happens is you come off that first ball screen against the 2-3, you invariably or inevitably waste another dribble, which allows the help to play the ball, get back to their man. There's been no advantage gained. Now, I'm not sure if that's not as much continuity or set play. It's more of a concept. So I think it's more conceptual for me. It's more behind the defense. It's more, where are we going to get fouled? Where can we get the seals? And what position against their zone do we want to try to eliminate from them as much as possible? And then I'll say this to the players a lot, because invariably the zone slows them down. Mentally, slows them down physically. They see it. And it's almost becomes, okay, if we've called it, run it. But when in doubt, screen and pass, right? Ball screen and pass it. Ball screen and pass it. And the concepts really don't change. You know, you want to get it reversed. You want to create the 2-on-1. You want to make X, 4, and 5 give help. And you don't want them thinking about that when it's going. You just want them to play. So it's that more than anything else. And we've had games where we've just run our man offense 80 to 90% of the time, all right, more than what we would run a zone offensive play, and had success with it.
Walter, speaking of success against man or zone, not man and zone, man or zone, in your out of bounds under packages, do you have sets that you know, no matter what defense they throw out there, it will work against man or zone?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. we have some key sets, you know, that we get pretty good shot selection from. So to answer that question, yes, we run, you know, left side, right side, you know, inside seals, you know, dive into the basket, break into the corner, decoys off the ball. We run a lot of different things out of a box and a 1-4 look.
Well, to finish up, I want to thank all of you for not only your time, but your amazing thoughts in this, but I wanted to have a little fun. Since our quarantine, one of the things that I've been amazed at is how much I've been eating. So I wanted to ask you, since the start of COVID-19, what have you been eating that you weren't eating before? Tom, let's start with you.
Oh, wow. I'm going to go in a good way. Way more fruit. Way more fruit. Still pizza. But you know what's been incredible about this? Because we've been together so much, Joni and then our three kids, is I knew my wife was a great cook. She's even better than that, right? She's been making so many more homemade meals, so you're not nibbling. And I am really thankful. I was already cutting away from fast food, but I've cut so far away from fast food. But I would go back to that original answer, eating fruit, but also late at night, definitely eating too much ice cream, which I definitely want to cut back.
Walter, how about you?
Yeah, so, you know, with since COVID, you know, obviously it was no really going out to eat. Our family has spent more time, you know, cooking out. So we've been grilling a lot and a lot of fruits and vegetables ourselves. You know, I would probably say, you know, as far as meats, you know, just seafood, you know, just grilling, you know, fish and salmon, but mostly just extra spinach and kale. I love spinach and kale. So now I'm really in love with it because that's all I've really been doing.
Why didn't we do this at his house? Why didn't we all just go to his house?
And
we
could have yeah, exactly.
That's unbelievable.
Yes.
Lindsay, how about you?
So, Tom, I think my husband had the opposite experience that you've had with Joni. He's saying, when are you going back to work and the practice facility and bringing back, you know, food from the chef and stuff? Because I've spent more time in the kitchen, but I don't necessarily think that's a good thing for anyone around here.
You're committed to your work, though. That's good. Don't apologize for that.
That's right. but I have done, I think my creativity in the kitchen has come with smoothies. I've been hitting that Peloton pretty hard. And so after the Peloton, I'll experiment with, you know, some exciting smoothies, some almond butter, some Greek yogurt, different fruits. That's the extent of my expertise in the kitchen at this point.
Well, I went way back to my childhood and have discovered the joy of Oreos again. And I've been hitting the Peloton, but no matter how much I ride it, I have still put on what I'm calling the COVID-19.
Yep.
Well, you guys, thanks for being with us. This was so great, and really appreciate all of your time and expertise, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Jay. Great job, everyone.
Thank you. Likewise.
You guys.
For more coaching resources, including our curriculum, please visit juniornba.com. I want to thank our friends at the NBA Coaches Association and eCoach for providing instructional content from their eCoach basketball video library to give our viewers an insider's perspective about how NBA coaches teach the topic we're focusing upon each week. For more information and to access the coaches video library, go to eCoachBasketball.com.
Next week on the Junior NBA Coaches Corner, Jay welcomes from the Milwaukee Bucks coaching staff, Darvin Ham and Josh Longstaff, and Hall of Famer, Stanford's Tara Vanderveer. Thanks for listening. Make sure to join Jay each week for the Junior NBA Coaches Corner. Go to juniornba.com or wherever your favorite podcasts are found.